When several females are attracted to his strong vocals at the same time and the alpha is busy copulating with one, the weaker male leaps in and mates one of the others. The imposter males were referred to as sneaky fuckers. Kaya remembered, those many years ago, Ma warning her older sisters about young men who over-revved their rusted-out pickups or drove jalopies around with radios blaring. "Unworthy boys make a lot of noise," Ma had said. She read a consolation for females. Nature is audacious enough to ensure that the males who send out dishonest signals or go from one female to the next almost always end up alone. Another article delved into the wild rivalries between sperm. Across most life forms, males compete to inseminate females. Male lions occasionally fight to the death. Rival bull elephants lock tusks and demolish the ground beneath their feet as they tear at each other's flesh. Though very ritualized, the conflicts can still end in mutilations. To avoid such injuries, inseminators of some species compete in less violent, more creative methods. Insects, the most imaginative. The penis of the male damselfly is equipped with a small scoop, which removes sperm ejected by a previous opponent before he supplies his own. Kaya dropped the journal on her lap, her mind drifting with the clouds. Some female insects eat their mates. Overstressed mammal mothers abandon their young. Many males design risky or shifty ways to outsperm their competitors. Nothing seemed too indecorous as long as the tick and the talk of life carried on. She knew this was not a dark side to nature, just inventive ways to endure against all odds. Surely for humans there was more. After finding Kaya gone 3 days in a row, Chase started asking if he could come on a certain day, at a given time to see her at her shack or this or that beach, and always arrived on time. From far off, she would see his brightly colored boat, like vivid feathers of a male bird's breeding plumage, floating on the waves, and know he'd come just for her. Kaya started to picture him taking her on a picnic with his friends, all of them laughing, running into the waves, kicking the surf. Him lifting her, swirling around, then sitting with the others, sharing sandwiches and drinks from coolers. Bit by bit, pictures of marriage and children formed in spite of her resistance. "Probably some biological urge to push me into reproducing," she told herself. But why couldn't she have loved ones like everybody else? Why not? Yet every time she tried to ask when he would introduce her to his friends and parents, the words stuck to her tongue. Drifting offshore on a hot day a few months after they met, he said it was perfect for a swim.
"I won't look," he said. "Take off your clothes and jump in, then I will."
She stood in front of him, balancing in the boat. But as she pulled her t-shirt over her head, he didn't turn away. He reached out and ran his fingers lightly across her firm breasts. She didn't stop him. Pulling her closer, he unzipped her shorts and slipped them easily from her slender hips. Then he took off his shirt and shorts and pushed her down gently onto the towels. Kneeling at her feet, without saying a word, he ran his fingers like a whisper along her left ankle, up to the inside of her knee, slowly along the inside of her thigh. She raised her body toward his hand. His fingers lingered at the top of her thigh, rubbed over her panties, then moved across her belly, light as a thought. She sensed his fingers moving up her stomach toward her breasts and twisted her body away from him. Firmly, he pushed her flat and slid his fingers to her breast, slowly outlining the nipple with one finger. He looked at her, unsmiling, as he moved his hand down and pulled at the top of her panties. She wanted him. All of him. And her body pushed against his. But seconds later, she put her hand on his.
Come on, Kaya, he said. Please. We've waited forever. I've been pretty patient, don't you think?
Chase, you promised.
Damn it, Kaya. What are we waiting for?
He sat up.
Surely I showed you I care for you. Why not?
Sitting up, she pulled down her t-shirt. What happens next?
How do I know you won't leave me? How does anybody ever know? But Kaya, I'm not going anywhere. I'm falling in love with you. I want to be with you all the time. What else can I do to show you?
He had never mentioned love. Kaya searched his eyes for truth, but found only a hard stare, unreadable. She didn't know exactly how she felt about Chase, but she was no longer lonely. That seemed enough. Soon, okay? He pulled her close to him.
It's okay. Come here.
He held her, and they lay under the sun, drifting on the sea, the slosh, slosh, slosh of the waves beneath them. Day drained away and night settled heavily, the village lights dancing here and there on the distant shore, stars twinkling above their world of sea and sky. Chase said,
I wonder what makes stars twinkle.
Disturbance in the atmosphere. You know, like high atmospheric winds.
That so?
I'm sure you know that most stars are too far away for us to see. We see only their light, which can be distorted by the atmosphere. But of course, the stars are not stationary, but moving very fast. Kaya knew from reading Albert Einstein's books that time is no more fixed than the stars. Time speeds and bends around planets and suns, is different in the mountains than in the valleys, and is part of the same fabric as space, which curves and swells as does the sea. Objects, whether planets or apples, fall or orbit, not because of a gravitational energy, but because they plummet into the silky folds of space-time, like into the ripples on a pond, created by those of higher mass. But Kaya said none of this. Unfortunately, gravity holds no sway on human thought. And the high school text still taught that apples fall to the ground because of a powerful force from the earth.
Oh, guess what? Chase said. They've asked me to help coach the high school football team.
She smiled at him. Then thought, like everything else in the universe, we tumble toward those of higher mass. The next morning, on a rare trip to the Piggly Wiggly to buy personal items Jumpin' didn't carry, Kaya stepped out of the grocery and nearly bumped right into Chase's parents, Sam and Patty Love. They knew who she was. Everyone did. She'd seen them in town occasionally through the years, mostly from a distance. Sam could be seen behind the counter in the Western Auto, dealing with customers, opening the cash register. Kaya remembered how, when she was a girl, he shooed her away from the window as though she might frighten away real customers. Patty Love didn't work full-time at the store, allowing time for her to hurry along the street, handing out pamphlets for the annual quilting contest or the Blue Crab Queen Festival. Always dressed in a fine outfit with high heel pumps, pocketbook, and hat in matching colors demanded by the southern season. No matter the subject, she managed to mention Chase as being the best quarterback the town had ever seen. Kaya smiled shyly, looking right into Patty Love's eyes, hoping they would speak to her in some personal way and introduce themselves. Maybe acknowledge her as Chase's girl. But they halted abruptly, said nothing, and sidestepped around her, making a wider berth than necessary. Moved on. The evening after bumping into them, Kaya and Chase drifted in her boat under an oak so huge its knees jutted over the water, creating little grottos for otters and ducks. Keeping her voice low, partly so she wouldn't disturb the mallards and partly in fear, Kaya told Chase about seeing his parents and asked if she would meet them soon. Chase sat silent, making her stomach lump up. Finally, he said,
"Course you will. Soon, I promise."
But he didn't look at her when he said it.
"They know about me, right? About us?" she asked.
"Of course."
The boat must have drifted too close to the oak, because right then a great horned owl, plump and cushy as a down pillow, dropped from the tree on reaching wings, then stroked slow and easy across the lagoon, his breast feathers reflecting soft patterns on the water. Chase reached out and took Kaya's hand, wringing the doubt from her fingers. For weeks, sunsets and moonrises followed Chase and Kaya's easy movements through the marsh. But each time she resisted his advances, he stopped. Images of does or turkey hens alone with their demanding young, the males long gone to other females, weighed solid in her mind. Lying around near naked in the boat was as far as it went, no matter what the townspeople said. Although Chase and Kaya kept to themselves, the town was small, and people saw them together in his boat or on the beaches. The shrimpers didn't miss much on the seas. There was talk. Tittle-tattle. Chapter 27 Out Hog Mountain Road, 1966. The shack stood silent against the early stir of blackbird wings, as an earnest winter fog formed along the ground, bunching up against the walls like large wisps of cotton. Using several weeks of muscle money, Kaya had bought special groceries and fried slices of molasses ham, stirred red-eye gravy, and served them with sour cream biscuits and blackberry jam. Chase drank instant Maxwell House. She, hot Tetley tea. They'd been together nearly a year, though neither spoke of that. Chase said how lucky he was that his father owned the Western Auto.
"This way we'll have a nice house when we get married. I'm going to build you a two-story on the beach with a wraparound veranda, or whatever kind of house you want, Kaya."
Kaya could barely breathe. He wanted her in his life. Not just a hint, but something like a proposal. She would belong to someone, be part of a family. She sat straighter in her chair. He continued.
"I don't think we should live right in town. That'd be too much of a jump for you. But we could build a place on the outskirts, you know, close to the marsh."
Lately, a few vague thoughts of marriage to Chase had formed in her mind. But she had not dared dwell on them. But here he was, saying it out loud. Kaya's breath was shallow, her mind disbelieving and sorting details all at the same time. "I can do this," she thought. "If we live away from people, it could work." Then, head low, she asked, "What about your parents? Have you told them?"
"Kaya, you got to understand something about my folks. They love me. If I say you're my choice, that'll be that. They'll just fall in love with you when they get to know you."
She chewed on her lips, wanting to believe.
"I'll build a studio for all your stuff," he continued, "with big windows so you can see the details of all those dad-burned feathers."
She didn't know if she felt about Chase the way a wife should, but in this moment her heart soared with something like love. No more digging muscles. She reached out and touched the shell necklace under his throat.
"Oh, by the way," Chase said, I have to drive over to Asheville in a few days to buy goods for the store. I was thinking, why don't you come with me?
Eyes downcast, she'd said.
But that's a large town.
There'd be lots of people, and I don't have the right clothes, or don't even know what the right clothes are, and... Kaya, Kaya, listen, you'd be with me. I know everything. We don't have to go anywhere fancy. You'd see a lot of North Carolina just driving over. The Piedmont, the Great Smoky Mountains, for Christ's sake. Then when we got there, we could just go to a drive-in for burgers. You can wear what you have on. You don't have to talk to one soul if you don't want to. I'll take care of everything. I've been lots of times, even to Atlanta. Asheville's nothing. Look, if we're going to get married, you might as well start getting out in the world a bit. Spread those long wings of yours.
She nodded. If nothing else, to see the mountains. He continued.
It's a 2-day job, so we'll have to stay overnight. In a casual place, you know, a small motel. It's okay, because we're adults.
Oh, was all she said, then whispered,
I see.
Kaya had never driven up the road a piece, so a few days later, as she and Chase rode west out of Barkley in his pickup, she stared out the window, holding on to the seat with both hands. The road wound through miles of sawgrass and palmettos, leaving the sea in the rear window. For more than an hour, the familiar reaches of grass and waterways slipped by the truck's window. Kaya identified marsh wrens and egrets, comforted by the sameness, like she hadn't left home but brought it with her. Then, abruptly, at a line drawn across the earth, the marsh meadows ended and dusty ground, hacked raw, fenced into squares and furrowed into rows, spread before them. Fields of paraplegic snags stood in felled forests. Poles strung with wires trudged toward the horizon. Of course, she knew coastal marsh didn't cover the globe, but she'd never been beyond it. What had people done to the land? Every house, the same shoebox shape, squatted on sheared lawn. A flock of pink flamingos fed across a yard, but when Kaya whirled in surprise, she saw they were plastic. The deer, cement. The only ducks flew painted on mailboxes.
They're incredible, huh? Chase said.
What?
The houses. You've never seen anything like them, huh?
No, I haven't.
Hours later, out on the flatlands of the Piedmont, she saw the Appalachians sketched in gentle blue lines along the horizon. As they neared, peaks rose around them and forested mountains flowed softly into the distance as far as Kaya could see. Clouds lazed in the folded arms of the hills, then billowed up and drifted away. Some tendrils twisted into tight spirals and traced the warmer ravines, behaving like mist tracking the dank fens of the marsh. The same game of physics playing on a different field of biology. Kaya was of the Low Country, a land of horizons, where the sun set and the moon rose on time. But here, where the topography was a jumble, the sun balanced along the summits, setting behind a ridge one moment, and then popping up again when Chase's truck ascended the next rise. In the mountains, she noticed, the time of sunset depended on where you stood on the hill. She wondered where her grandpa's land was. Maybe her kin had kept pigs in a weather-grade barn like the one she saw in a meadow, creek running by. A family that should have been hers once toiled, laughed, and cried in this landscape. Some would still be here, scattered through the county. Anonymous. The road became a 4-lane highway, and Kaya held on tight as Chase's truck sped within feet of other fast-moving vehicles. He turned onto a curving roadway that rose magically into the air and led them toward the town.
A cloverleaf exit, he said proudly.
Enormous buildings, 8 and 10 stories high, stood against the outline of the mountains. Scores of cars scuttled like sand crabs, and there were so many people on the sidewalks. Kaya pushed her face to the window, searching their faces, thinking surely Ma and Pa must be among them. One boy, tanned and dark-haired, running down the sidewalk, looked like Jody, and she spun around to watch him. Her brother would be grown now, of course. But she tracked the boy until they turned a corner. On the other side of town, Chase booked them into a motel out Hog Mountain Road, a single-story row of brown rooms lit up by neon lights the shape of palm trees, of all things. After Chase unlocked their door, she stepped into a room that seemed clean enough, but reeked of pine sole, and was furnished in America cheap. Fake panel walls, sagging bed with a nickel vibrator machine, and a black-and-white TV secured to the table with an impossibly large chain and padlock. The bedspreads were lime green, the carpet orange shag. Kaya's mind went back to all the places they had lain together, in crystal sand by tidal pools, in moonlit drifting boats. Here, the bed loomed as the centerpiece, but the room didn't look like love. She stood knowingly near the door.
"It's not great," he said, putting his duffel bag on the chair. He walked toward her. "It's time. Don't you agree, Kaya? It's time."
Of course, it had been his plan, but she was ready. Her body had been longing for months, and after the talk of marriage, her mind gave in. She nodded. He came toward her slowly and unbuttoned her blouse, then turned her gently around and unfastened her bra, traced his fingers across her breasts. An excited heat flowed from her breasts to her thighs. As he pulled her down onto the bed in the glow of the red and green neon lights filtering through thin curtains, she closed her eyes. Before, during all those almost times when she had stopped him, his wandering fingers had taken on a magical touch, bringing parts of her to life, causing her body to arch toward him, to long and want. But now, with permission finally granted, an urgency gripped him, and he seemed to bypass her needs and push his way. She cried out against a sharp tearing, thinking something was wrong.
"It's okay. It'll be better now," he said with great authority.
But it didn't get much better, and soon he fell to her side, grinning. As he passed into sleep, she watched the blinking lights of the vacancy sign. Several weeks later, after finishing a breakfast of fried eggs and ham grits at Kaya's shack, she and Chase sat at her kitchen table. She was wrapped snugly in a blanket after lovemaking, which had improved only slightly since their first attempt at the motel. Each time left her wanting, but she didn't have the faintest notion how to broach such a subject. And anyway, she didn't know how she was supposed to feel. Maybe this was normal. Chase stood from the table, and lifting her chin with his fingers, kissed her, saying,
"Well, I won't be out much in the next few days with Christmas coming up and all. There's lots of events and stuff and some relatives coming in."
Kaya looked up at him and said,
"I was hoping maybe I could, you know, go to some of the parties and things. At least maybe Christmas dinner with your family."
Chase sat back down in his chair.
"Kaya, look, I've been wanting to talk to you about this. I want to ask you to the Elks Club dance and stuff like that, but I know how shy you are, how you don't ever do stuff in town. I know you'd be miserable. You wouldn't know anybody. You don't have the right clothes. Do you even know how to dance? None of those things are what you do. You understand that, right?"
Looking at the floor, she said,
"Yes, and all that's true. But, well, I have to start fitting in with some of your life. Spread my wings, like you said. I guess I have to get the right clothes, meet some of your friends.
She raised her head.
You could teach me to dance.
Well, sure, and I will. But I think of you and me as what we have out here. I love our time here together, just you and me. To tell you the truth, I'm getting kind of tired of those stupid dances. Been the same for years. High school, gym, old folks, young folks all together. Same dumb music. I'm ready to move on. You know, when we're married, we won't do stuff like that anyway, so why drag you into it now? Don't make any sense. Okay?
She looked back at the floor. So he lifted her chin again and held her eyes with his own. Then, grinning big, he said,
And man, as far as having Christmas dinner with my family, my ancient aunts come in from Florida, never stop talking. I wouldn't wish that on anybody, especially you. Believe me, you ain't missing a thing.
She was silent.
Really, Kaya, I want you to be okay with this. What we have out here is the most special thing anybody could hope for. All that other stuff,
he swiped his hands through the air,
is just stupid.
He reached over and pulled her into his lap, and she rested her head on his shoulder.
This is where it's at, Kaya. Not that other stuff.
And he kissed her, warm and tender, then stood.
Okay, gotta go.
Kaya spent Christmas alone with the gulls, as she had every year since Ma left. 2 days after Christmas, Chase still hadn't come. Breaking herself promise to never wait for anyone again, Kaya paced the shore of the lagoon, her hair woven into a French braid, mouth painted with Ma's old lipstick. The marsh beyond lay in its winter cloak of browns and grays. Miles of spent grasses, having dispersed their seeds, bowed their heads to the water in surrender. The wind whipped and tore, rattling the coarse stems in a noisy chorus. Kaya yanked her hair down and wiped her lips with the back of her hand. The morning of the fourth day, she sat alone in the kitchen pushing biscuits and eggs around her plate.
For all his talk of this being where it's at, where is he now? She spat.
In her mind, she saw Chase playing touch football with friends or dancing at parties.
Those stupid things he's getting tired of.
Finally, the sound of his boat. She sprang from the table, banged the door shut, and ran from the shack to the lagoon as the boat chugged into view. But it wasn't Chase's ski boat or Chase. But a young man with yellow gold hair, cut shorter but still barely contained under a ski cap. It was the old fishing rig. And there, standing, even as the boat moved forward, was Tate, grown into a man. Face no longer boyish, but handsome, mature. His eyes formed a question, his lips a shy smile. Her first thought was to run, but her mind screamed, No! This is my lagoon. I always run, not this time. Her next thought was to pick up a rock, and she hurled it at his face from 20 feet. He ducked quickly, the stone whizzing by his forehead.
Shit, Kaya! What the hell? Wait!
He said as she picked up another rock and took aim. He put his hands over his face.
Kaya, for God's sake! Stop! Please! Can't we talk?
The rock hit him hard on the shoulder.
Get out of my lagoon, you low-down, dirty creep! How's that for talk?
The screaming fishwife looked frantically for another rock.
Kaya, listen to me. I know you're with Chase now. I respect that. I just want to talk with you. Please, Kaya.
Why should I talk with you? I never want to see you again, ever.
She picked up a handful of smaller stones and slung them at his face. He jerked to the side, bent forward, and grabbed the gunwale as his boat ran aground.
I said, get out of here!
Still yelling, but softer, she said, yes, I am with someone else now. Tate steadied himself after the jolt of hitting the shore, and then sat on the bow seat of his boat.
Kaya, please. There are things you should know about him.
Tate had not planned on having a conversation about Chase. None of this surprise visit to see Kaya was going as he'd imagined.
What are you talking about?
You have no right to talk to me about my private life.
She had walked up to within 5 feet of him and spat her words. Firmly, he said,
I know I don't, but I'm doing it anyway.
At this, Kaya turned to leave. But Tate talked louder at her back.
You don't live in town. You don't know that Chase goes out with other women. Just the other night, I watched him drive away after a party with a blonde in his pickup. He's not good enough for you.
She whirled around.
Oh, really? You are the one who left me? Who didn't come back when you promised? Who never came back? You are the one who never wrote to explain why, or even if you were alive or dead. You didn't have the nerve to break up with me. You were not man enough to face me. Just disappeared. Chicken shit, asshole. You come floating in here after all these years? You're worse than he is. He might not be perfect, but you're worse by a long shot.
She stopped abruptly, staring at him. Palms open, he pleaded.
You're right about me, Kaya. Everything you said is true. I was a chicken shit. And I had no right to bring up Chase. It's none of my business. And I'll never bother you again. I just need to apologize and explain things. I've been sorry for years, Kaya. Please.
She hung like a sail where the wind just went out. Tate was more than her first love. He shared her devotion to the marsh, had taught her to read, and was the only connection, however small, to her vanished family. He was a page of time, a clipping pasted in a scrapbook because it was all she had. Her heart pounded as the fury dissipated.
Look at you. So beautiful. A woman. You doing okay? Still selling muscles?
He was astonished at how she had changed. Her features more refined yet haunting. Her cheekbones sharp, lips full.
Yes, yes.
Here, I brought you something.
From an envelope, he handed her a tiny red cheek feather from a northern flicker. She thought of tossing it on the ground, but she'd never found this feather. Why shouldn't she keep it? She tucked it in her pocket and didn't thank him. Talking fast, he said,
Kaya, leaving you was not only wrong, it was the worst thing I have done or ever will do in my life. I have regretted it for years and will always regret it. I think of you every day. For the rest of my life, I'll be sorry I left you. I truly thought that you wouldn't be able to leave the marsh and live in the other world, so I didn't see how we could stay together. But that was wrong, and it was bullshit that I didn't come back and talk to you about it. I knew how many times you'd been left before. I didn't want to know how badly I hurt you. I was not man enough, just like you said.
He finished and watched her. Finally, she said,
What do you want now, Tate?
If only you could, some way, forgive me.
He breathed in and waited. Kaya looked at her toes. Why should the injured, the still bleeding, bear the onus of forgiveness? She didn't answer.
I just had to tell you, Kaya.
When still she said nothing, he continued.
I'm in graduate school. Zoology. Proto-zoology, mostly. You would love it.
She couldn't imagine it, and looked back over the lagoon to see if Chase was coming. Tate didn't miss this. He'd guessed right off she was out here waiting for Chase. Just last week, Tate had watched Chase, in his white dinner jacket at the Christmas gala, dancing with different women. The dance, like most Barclay Cove events, had been held at the high school gymnasium. As Wooly Bully struggled from a too small hi-fi set up under the basketball hoop, Chase whirled a brunette. When Mr. Tambourine Man began, he left the dance floor and the brunette and shared pulls of wild turkey from his Tar Heels flask with other former jocks. Tate was close by chatting with two of his old high school teachers and heard Chase say,
"Yeah, she's wild as a she-fox in a snare. Just what you'd expect from a marsh minx. Worth every bit of the gas money."
Tate had to force himself to walk away. A cold wind whipped up and rippled across the lagoon. Expecting Chase, Kaya had run out in her jeans and light sweater. She folded her arms tightly around herself.
"You're freezing. Let's go inside."
Tate motioned toward the shack, where smoke puffed from the rusty stovepipe.
"Tate, I think you should leave now."
She threw several quick glances at the channel. What if Chase arrived with Tate here?
"Kaya, please. Just for a few minutes.
I really want to see your collections again."
As answer, she turned and ran to the shack, and Tate followed her. Inside the porch, he stopped short. Her collections had grown from a child's hobby to a natural history museum of the marsh. He lifted a scallop shell, labeled with a watercolor of the beach where it was found, plus insets showing the creature eating smaller creatures of the sea. For each specimen, hundreds, maybe thousands of them, it was the same. He had seen some of them before, as a boy, but now, as a doctoral candidate in zoology, he saw them as a scientist. He turned to her, still standing in the doorway.
"Kaya, these are wonderful. Beautifully detailed. You could publish these. This could be a book. Lots of books."
"No, no. They're just for me. They help me learn, is all."
"Kaya, listen to me. You know better than anybody that the reference books for this area are almost non-existent. With these notations, technical data, and splendid drawings, these are the books everyone's been waiting for."
It was true. Ma's old guidebooks to the shells, plants, birds, and mammals of the area were the only ones printed, and they were pitifully inaccurate, with only simple black-and-white pictures and sketchy information on each entry.
"If I can take a few samples, I'll find out about a publisher. See what they say."
She stared, not knowing how to see this. Would she have to go somewhere? Meet people? Tate didn't miss the questions in her eyes.
"You wouldn't have to leave home. You could mail your samples to a publisher. They would bring some money in. Probably not a huge amount, but maybe you wouldn't have to dig mussels the rest of your life."
Still, Kaya didn't say anything. Once again, Tate was nudging her to care for herself, not just offering to care for her. It seemed that all her life he had been there, then gone.
"Give it a try, Kaya. What can it hurt?"
She finally agreed that he could take some samples, and he chose a selection of soft watercolors of shells and the great blue heron because of her detailed sketches of the bird in each season, and a delicate oil of the curved eyebrow feather. Tate lifted the painting of the feather, a profusion of hundreds of the thinnest brushstrokes of rich colors culminating into a deep black so reflective it seemed sunlight was touching the canvas. The detail of a slight tear in the shaft was so distinctive that both Tate and Kaya realized at the same second that this was a painting of the very first feather he'd gifted her in the forest. They looked up from the feather into each other's eyes. She turned away from him, forcing herself not to feel. She would not be drawn back to someone she couldn't trust. He stepped up to her and touched her shoulder, tried gently to turn her around.
Kaya, I'm so sorry about leaving you.
Please,
can't you forgive me?
Finally, she turned and looked at him.
I don't know how to, Tate. I could never believe you again. Please, Tate, you have to go now.
I know. Thank you for listening to me, for giving me this chance to apologize.
He waited for a beat, but she said no more. At least he was leaving with something. The hope for a publisher was a reason to contact her again.
Goodbye, Kaya.
She didn't answer. He stared at her, and she looked into his eyes, but then turned away. He walked out the door toward his boat. She waited until he was gone, then sat on the damp, cold sand of the lagoon waiting for Chase. Speaking out loud, she repeated the words she'd said to Tate.
Chase may not be perfect, but you're worse.
But as she stared deep into the dark waters, Tate's words about Chase,
drive away after a party with a blonde in his pickup,
wouldn't leave her mind. Chase didn't come until a week after Christmas. Pulling into the lagoon, he said he could stay all night, ring in the new year together. Arm in arm, they walked to the shack, where the same fog, it seemed, draped across the roof. After lovemaking, they cuddled in blankets around the stove. The dense air couldn't hold another molecule of moisture, so when the kettle boiled, heavy droplets swelled on the cool window panes. Chase slipped the harmonica from his pocket, and pressing it along his lips, played the wistful tune Molly Malone.
Now her ghost wheels her barrow through the streets broad and narrow, singing cockles and mussels, alive, alive-o.
It seemed to Kaya that when Chase played these melancholy tunes was when he most had a soul. Chapter 28 The Shrimper, 1969. At beer time, the doggone served up better gossip than the diner. The sheriff and Joe stepped inside the elongated, jam-packed beer hall and up to the bar, made from a single longleaf pine, which extended down the left side of the room, seemingly out of sight into the dim. Locals, all men since women weren't allowed, bunched up to the bar or sat at scattered tables. The two barkeeps roasted hot dogs, fried shrimp, oysters, and hush puppies, stirred grits, poured beers and bourbon. The only light emitted from various flashing beer signs, giving off an amber glow, like campfires licking whiskered faces. The clunks and clinks of billiard balls sounded from the back quarter. Ed and Joe eased into a mid-bar cluster of fishermen. And as soon as they ordered Miller's and fried oysters, the questions began. Anything new? How come there's no fingerprints? That part true? You guys thought of old man Hansen? He's crazy as a loon. Be just like somethin' he'd do. Climb the tower, push off whoever comes along. This un got you bum fuzzled, ain't it? Joe facing one way, Ed the other. They rode the buzz. Answering, listening, nodding. Then, through the hubbub, the sheriff's ear caught the corner of an even voice, a balanced tone, and turned to face Hal Miller, shrimper crew for Tim O'Neill.
Can I talk with you a minute, Sheriff? Alone?
Ed backed away from the bar.
Sure can, Hal. Come with me.
He led him to a small table next to the wall, and they sat.
Need a refill on that beer?
No, fine for now. Thank you, though.
Something on your mind, Hal?
Yeah, sure is. Gotta get her out, too. Been driving me a bit ditty.
Let's have it,
Oh, man.
Hal shook his head.
I don't know. Maybe nothing. Either that, or I should have told you sooner. I've been haunted by what I seen. Just tell me, Hal. Together, we'll sort out if it's important or not.
Well, it's about the Chase Andrews thing. It was the very night he died. Well, I was crewing for Tim, and we were coming into the bay late, way past midnight, and me and Alan Hunt seen that woman, the one people called a marsh girl, motoring just out of the bay.
Is that so? How long after midnight?
Must have been about 1:45 in the morning.
Where was she motoring?
Well, that's the thing, Sheriff. She was headed right toward the fire tower. If she stayed her course, she would have landed at that little bay out from the tower.
Ed breathed out.
Yeah, Hal. That's important info. Very important. Can you be sure it was her?
Well, Alan and I talked about it at the time, and were pretty sure it was her. I mean, we both thought the same thing. Wondered what the hell she was doing out that late, cruising along with no lights on. Lucky we seen her. Might have run her over. Then we just forgot about it. It was only later I put two and two together and realized it was the same night Chase died at the tower. Well, then I reckoned I better speak up.
Did anybody else on the boat see her?
Well, I don't know about that. Others were about for sure. We were heading in, all hands up. But I never talked to the others about it. You know, just no reason to at the time. And haven't asked them since.
I understand. Hal, you did the right thing to tell me. It's your duty to speak up like this.
Don't worry about anything.
All you can do is tell me what you saw. I'll ask you and Alan in to make a statement. Can I buy you that beer now?
No. I think I'll just go on home. Good night.
Good night. Thanks again.
As soon as Hal stood, Ed waved for Joe, who had been glancing over every few seconds to read the sheriff's face. They gave Hal a minute to clear the room with goodbyes, then stepped onto the street. Ed told Joe what Hal had witnessed.
Man, Joe said, that just about does it. Don't you think?
I think the judge may issue a warrant on this. Not sure, and I'd like to be sure before I ask. With a warrant, we can search her place for any trace of red fibers that match those found on Chase's clothes. We got to find out her story for that night.
Chapter 29 Seaweed 1967 Through the winter, Chase came to Kaya's shack often, usually spending one night each weekend. Even on cold, damp days, they glided through misty thickets, her collecting, him playing whimsical tunes on his harmonica. The notes floated with the fog, dissipating into the darker reaches of the lowland forests, and seemed somehow to be absorbed and memorized by the marsh, because whenever Kaya passed those channels again, she heard his music. One morning in early March, Kaya eased alone through the sea toward the village, the sky in a frumpy sweater of gray clouds. Chase's birthday was in 2 days, and she was headed to the Piggly to buy ingredients for a special supper, featuring her first caramel cake. Had pictured setting the candle-lit cake in front of him at the table, an event that hadn't happened in the kitchen since Ma left. Several times recently, he'd said he was saving money for their house. She reckoned she'd better learn to bake. After securing her boat, as she walked along the dock toward the single file of shops, she saw Chase standing at the end talking with friends. His arms draped the shoulders of a slim blonde girl. Kaya's mind strained to make sense of this. even as her legs kept moving on their own. She'd never approached him when he was with others or in town, but short of jumping into the sea, there was no way to avoid them. Chase and his friends turned at once to look at her, and in the same instant, he dropped his arm from the girl. Kaya was dressed in white cut-off denims, setting off her long legs. A black braid fell over each breast. The group stopped talking and stared. Knowing she couldn't run up to him burned her heart with the wrongness of things. As she reached the end of the wharf where they stood, he said,
"Oh, Kaya. Hi."
Looking from him to them, she said,
"Hi, Chase."
She heard him saying, "Kaya, you remember Brian and Tim, Pearl, Tina?" He rattled off a few more names until his voice faded. Turning toward Kaya, he said, "And this is Kaya Clark." Of course she didn't remember them. She'd never been introduced to them. Only knew them as Tall Skinny Blonde and the rest. She felt like seaweed dragged on a line, but managed to smile and say hello. This was the opportunity for which she'd waited. Here she was, standing among the friends she wanted to join. Her mind fought for words, something clever to say that might interest them. Finally, two of them greeted her coolly and turned abruptly away, the others following quickly like a school of minnows finning down the street.
"Well, so here we are," Chase said.
"I don't want to interrupt anything. I've just come for supplies, then back home."
"You're not interrupting. I just ran into them. I'll be out on Sunday, like I said."
Chase shifted his feet, fingered the shell necklace.
"I'll see you then," she said.
But he'd already turned to catch the others. She hurried toward the market, stepping around a family of mallard ducks waddling down Main Street, their bright feet surprisingly orange against the dull pavement. In the Piggly Wiggly, pushing the vision of Chase and the girl from her head, she rounded the end of the bread aisle and saw the truant lady, Mrs. Culpepper, only 4 feet away. They stood there like a rabbit and a coyote caught together in a yard fence. Kaya was now taller than the woman, and much more educated, though neither would have thought of that. After all the running, she wanted to bolt, but stood her ground and returned Mrs. Culpepper's stare. The woman nodded slightly, then moved on. Kaya found the picnic items, cheese, French bread, and cake ingredients, costing all the money she'd managed to save for the occasion. But it seemed someone else's hand lifted the items and put them into the cart. All she could see was Chase's arm resting on the girl's shoulder. She bought a local newspaper because the headlines mentioned a marine laboratory that was to open up the coast nearby. Once out of the store, head down, she scurried like a robber ferret to the pier. Back at the shack, she sat down at the kitchen table to read the article about the new lab. Sure enough, a swanky scientific facility was being developed 20 miles south of Barkley Cove near Sea Oaks. Scientists would study the ecology of the marsh, which contributed to the survival of almost half of sea life in one way or another, and Kaya turned the page to continue the story. And there loomed a large picture of Chase and a girl above an engagement announcement. Andrews Stone. Bunches of words jumped out, then sobs, and finally ragged heaves. She stood, looking at the paper from a distance, picked it up again to see. Surely she had imagined it. There they were. Their faces close together, smiling. The girl, Pearl Stone, beautiful, rich-looking, with a pearl necklace and lace blouse. The one his arm had been around, always wears pearls. Touching the wall, Kaya made her way to the porch and fell on the bed. hands over her opened mouth. Then she heard a motor. Abruptly, she sat up, looked toward the lagoon, and saw Chase pulling his boat onto the shore. Quick as a mouse escaping a lidless box, she slipped out the porch door before he saw her and ran into the woods, away from the lagoon. Squatting behind palmettos, she watched as he went into the shack, calling her. He would see the article spread open on the table. In a few minutes, he came out again and walked toward the beach, figuring he would find her there. She didn't budge, even when he came back, still shouting her name. Not until he motored away did she emerge from the brambles. Moving sluggishly, she got food for the gulls and followed the sun to the beach. A strong ocean breeze pushed up the path, so that when she emerged on the beach, at least she had the wind to lean on. She called the gulls and flung large bits of French bread into the air, then swore louder and meaner than the wind. Chapter 30. The Rips, 1967. From the beach, Kaya ran to her rig and roared full throttle into the sea, headed straight for the rips. Holding her head back, she screamed, "You mean shit, some bitch!" Sloppy and confused waves jerked the bow sideways, pulling against the tiller. As always, the ocean seemed angrier than the marsh. Deeper, it had more to say. Long ago, Kaya had learned how to read ordinary currents and riptides, how to ride them out or break away by cutting perpendicular to their course. But she'd never headed straight into the deeper currents, some of them stirred by the Gulf Stream, which gushes 4 billion cubic feet of water every second, more power than all the land rivers on Earth combined, all streaming just beyond North Carolina's outstretched arms. The surge produces cruel back currents, fisted eddies, and reverse circulations that swirl with coastal riptides, birthing one of the nastiest snake pits of the planet's seas. Kaya had avoided these areas all her life, but not now. Today, she aimed straight for their throats. Anything to outrun the pain, the anger. Roiling water pushed toward her, rising under the bow and yanking the boat starboard. It heaved heavily, then righted. She was pulled into a furious rip, which carried her a quarter faster. Turning out of it seemed too risky, so she fought to steer with the current, watching for sandbars, which formed ever-shifting barriers beneath the surface. One glancing touch could flip her. Waves broke over her back, drenching her hair. Fast-moving, dark clouds streamed just above her head, blocking the sunlight and obscuring the signs of eddies and turbulence, sucking the day's heat. Still, fear eluded her. Even as she longed to feel terrified, anything to dislodge the blade jammed against her heart. Suddenly, the dark, tumbling waters of the current shifted, and the small rig spun starboard, rearing on its side. The force slammed her onto the bottom of the boat, seawater sloshing over her. Stunned, she sat in the water, bracing for another wave. Of course, she was nowhere near the actual Gulf Stream. This was the training camp, the mere playing fields for the serious sea. But to her, she had ventured into the mean and meant to ride it out, win something, kill the pain. Having lost all sense of symmetry and pattern, slate-colored waves broke from every angle. She dragged herself back into her seat and took the tiller, but didn't know where to steer. Land slung as a distant line, surfacing only now and then between white caps. Just when she glimpsed solid earth, the boat spun or tilted, and she lost sight of it. She'd been so sure about riding the current, but it had grown muscular, hauling her farther into the furious, darkening sea. The clouds bunched and settled low, blocking the sun. Wet through, She shivered as her energy drained, making it difficult